The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Jessen, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Judge Peter M. Reyes, Jr. is presiding.
Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar today, and three are set for oral argument. The first of which is A21-1718, Lance G. Carabao versus Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad Corporation. We are holding these oral arguments via Zoom.gov. So they're being held virtually. They are being recorded. However, no other recordings are permitted for these hearings, these oral arguments. For each party, you will have, as usual, 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 5 minutes for appellant. We will be following all the rules of appellate procedure for these proceedings. When you start your oral arguments, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. We do realize that there may be, from time to time, some technical difficulties or issues that might arise. If they do, we will do our best to accommodate each of the parties to make sure that each of you have the appropriate amount of time to hear and participate in the oral arguments. So with that, we will start with appellant. Please state your name for the record, party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Andrew Davick with the law firm Amesh Besher & Spence, and we represent the appellant Lance Caravu in the matter that brings us before the court today. I want to thank Your Honor's time and opposing counsel, and may it please the court. The issues before the court are twofold. This matter involves a motor vehicle train accident that occurred quite a few years ago in Dodge County, Minnesota. Our client, the appellant, was driving his vehicle on Highway 14, turned off and proceeded across a train tracks that runs adjacent to Highway 14 and was struck by a locomotive that was operated by respondent and respondent's employees. As a result of that collision, Mr. Caravu suffered very significant injuries. As Your Honors have probably seen from the record, Mr. Caravu does not have any specific recollection of the events of that day, which obviously makes some of the evidentiary hurdles that much more difficult regarding the claims in this case. Summary judgment was pursued by the respondents, and it was granted at the district court level based upon essentially two different factors. One, and I would address this first, is the issue of comparative fault, or as referenced in some of the briefs, sort of the antiquated term of contributory negligence. The court found in this matter that the facts weighed so heavily in favor of the respondent that there were no genuine issues of material fact that remained for the court or for the jury, the fact finder, and ultimately granted summary judgment. We are obviously asking the Court of Appeals to reverse that decision. We believe that was a reversible error by the district court in this matter. And I draw the court's attention to a few facts, and I don't want to belabor what's already been included in the briefs at the district court level and also obviously at the appellate level. But a few facts that I think are important here as it relates to the issues of comparative fault and why we believe this particular circumstance should have gone to the fact finder, i.e. the jury in this matter. One, the location of this crossing, this railroad crossing, is in a high traffic area. Highway 14 and that turnoff in particular is an area in which you see a lot of traffic that goes to one of the larger employers in Dodge County. It runs adjacent to Highway 14 along that area. There is a significant grove of trees to the east of that, the area in which Mr. Caravu was approaching. As you make that turn, those trees do provide some degree of obstruction. It's not completely obstructed. Appellant recognizes that, and that is not our claim here today.
Mr. David,
yes, Your Honor.
If I could stop you there, are you talking about the what you refer to as the copse of trees?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and how does that, I looked at those pictures. How does that obstruct the view at all? I mean, those are located quite a distance away from the actual railroad crossing that intersects with the road.
Yeah, you're correct, Your Honor. They are not immediately adjacent to the crossing itself. However, Mr. Caribou was traveling from the east. So as that vehicle travels from the east, it does obstruct. You can't necessarily see what is on the other side of that. And so you don't necessarily know what is coming from the east if a train, you know, the locations, et cetera. So it does create some issues as it relates to visibility. And I do agree, Your Honor, it's not an absolute. You know, that's a question of proper lookout, of course, right? Which is an issue for the jury. Was our client maintaining a proper lookout? It's a fact question. Does that obstruction itself provide enough of an issue that it should have been addressed by the railroad, or not even that it should have been addressed by the railroad, Your Honor, but whether or not it creates a heightened duty of care in those circumstances? When you look at the facts of this case, that's essentially the position of the appellants. When you take any one issue or any one problem as it existed at the time of this event, not one thing may have led to this incident, but it's a totality of them. So here we have the road, high traffic area. We have a crossing that does have trees. And again, Your Honor, I recognize what you're saying, but there is some degree of obstruction. The railroad crossing itself.
Also, I want to push back on that a little bit, because sure. When we look at the contributory negligence, there are actually a couple of issues here. One is that there were not one, but two traffic violations by appellant. One was basically use of using mobile technology that occurred both before and during the accident. Second is failing to stop and yield at the intersection. And in fact, I believe the uncontested evidence shows that he not only failed to stop, which was a violation, a traffic violation that he pleaded guilty to, but he actually accelerated to try to beat the train. And those two traffic violations generally are prima facie evidence of negligence, unless, and if they are not rebutted, they are conclusive. It's conclusive evidence of negligence. And when you are contributory negligent, you look at whether, to your point of the trees, you look at whether or not the colliding train would have been visible from the point where the traveler should have looked. Well, shouldn't you be looking before you cross the railroad? Isn't that really the key point of observation for the driver?
No, Your Honor, that's fair. And again, the position of the appellants here isn't that these facts do not exist, or there are not challenging facts that ultimately, if this issue were to be heard by a jury, wouldn't create some significant hurdles in terms of a potential positive resolution for the appellant. But with that being said, it's ultimately an issue of comparative fault. If there is some evidence, if there are claims, if there are some facts which show that based upon the totality of the information, that there is a possibility of a successful claim, those claims ultimately should go to the jury. So it's really an issue of comparative fault. We recognize there is a likelihood in a circumstance such as this that the appellant would likely have some degree of fault. As Your Honor pointed out, if the evidence at trial ultimately showed that failed to yield, entered the crosswalk without stopping, or did accelerate, or was on a mobile device, as some of the evidence that was presented to the district court indicated, those are things that would weigh not in favor of our client. We do not disagree with that, Your Honor, and not trying to necessarily hide from those facts. Those are facts that we have to deal with. Those are facts that we would have had to deal with in front of a jury. Our position is that you take those facts, and the jury should have had an opportunity to consider those facts. And they may have made a determination that ultimately the railroad had zero fault and the plaintiff had 100% of the fault. That happens in cases. We see it in automobile accident cases all the time. We see it in premises liability, slip and fall, whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, if there is some evidence, if there are claims that the railroad in a circumstance like this with a train track in close proximity to a very busy highway without any crossbucks or without any crossing guards, without any lights, that they could have approached this intersection in a different way. They could have gone slower. There have been a multitude of accidents at this particular intersection in the past and since that time, which is not relevant, of course, to this inquiry. But you have to weigh that evidence. Ultimately, that's where the fact finder comes in. And we recognize that there are challenges. These are challenging cases. We may very well not succeed on the merits when it gets to the jury. But that doesn't mean that it should be taken out of the hands of the fact finder and determined at the district court level by the presiding judge. That's essentially the position of the appellants in this matter, Your Honor, that there are sufficient enough facts that the comparative fault analysis, which is what Minnesota requires, should have gone to the jury, and there should have been a determination by the jury as to whether or not the railroad in this particular circumstance bears any responsibility for what happened in this particular case. And that's on the issue of comparative fault, Your Honor.
If I may.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I appreciate your approach in this, because this argument, because I've been trying to say, okay, where is there arguably factual support for DME's alleged negligence? And you're pointing to the at least partially obstructed view from your perspective. And then the crossings in a high traffic area. My question about that is, doesn't that factual dispute, if it's assuming it's disputed, doesn't it fall into your failure to warn claims, so that then we have to address the preemption issue?
Yeah, you do, Your Honor, you're right. I mean, there are presumption components to this, correct.
And I just want to kind of try and figure out where are those preemption components and where they aren't. So I would say, okay, clearly the high traffic area, there would be a preemption issue there. But not necessarily the partial obstruction. I'm just trying to understand your position here.
And let me be the first to say, Your Honor, I'm trying to thread a bit of a needle here. So it's challenging, because when you get into the preemption issue, you know, when you're dealing with the federal funds issue, there are certain things that we can't necessarily argue. We cannot argue that there should have been crossbars, because they're not there. And that was a determination made, and federal funds are provided for this particular intersection. We can't necessarily even argue that there should have been additional lights at that intersection or some other type of device, so to speak. So how we use that information, Your Honor, is to talk about that, but put it in the context of that day and the actions of the respondent. So what we do is we say, well, we recognize, Your Honor, that we couldn't make them do this. And we aren't necessarily going to be able to say that there's a negligence per se argument, that you should have had this and you didn't have it, therefore you're negligent. But the fact that those things did not exist go to the totality of the information as to the conduct of the railroad in that particular circumstance. So when you're looking at the conduct of the railroad, and let's say, for example, Your Honor, that you have a train that's traveling in downtown Minneapolis, the conduct of those train operators at a controlled versus an uncontrolled intersection are two different things. You know, they have to approach that differently. And that's the types of issues that ultimately the jury should be allowed to weigh in these cases. Not necessarily that they had to have A, B, or C, or D, but when those things did not exist, that it changes the dynamic in terms of the conduct of the defendant and whether or not that conduct rises to the level of actionable negligence in a case like this, and ultimately those issues should be heard by the jury. I hope that at least somewhat addresses the issue, because it's a challenging needle to try to thread in this particular circumstance. But that really does go to the issue of preemption. You know, we're not saying they had to have this or they had to have that, but because they didn't have those issues, it really changes the nature of the claim in terms of the railroad's actions on that particular day and how they should be approaching the intersection or what they're going to do. And so that is essentially the position of the appellants here as it relates also to the immunity issues.
So counsel, what are the specific material facts in dispute with respect to DME's negligence? You had mentioned that you talked about the partially obstructed trees, and I appreciate your explanation of trying to thread the needle, but I'm trying to figure out what are the specific disputed facts that point to DME's negligence.
Yeah, so Your Honor, the in terms of the disputed facts, I think it's applying those. The facts themselves are what they are. You know, the question is whether there are disputed facts here. I think we have a general understanding of what the factual allegations are, and I don't know that there are facts that are necessarily disputed. Now, it's challenging, obviously, because we have a plaintiff who doesn't have any specific recollection. So, you know, the operation of the phone or whether there was or was not acceleration. I mean, those are statements and obviously testimony from other individuals. And we don't necessarily have a way to rebut that per se, other than what might come out during the trial process. As to how those facts, however, apply to the law, we believe that when you take those facts, reasonable minds do have the ability to differ as to how those facts are looked at from the perspective of negligence. And when that jury is making those determinations and trying to decide whether or not there was a violation of the duty of care, could the railroad have done something different to prevent an accident like this? Were their actions on that day reasonable, which is really sort of the general negligence standard in Minnesota? And the jury ultimately gets to determine, are the actions of the defendant reasonable under these circumstances? Did they breach a duty? And did this ultimate breach of the duty lead to the events of that particular day? And that's really what we're asking the court to do here, is to return that matter back to the district court and give the ultimate fact finder, the jury in this circumstance, the opportunity to weigh all this information and weigh the facts. And like Your Honor said, there's not a lot of disputed facts. We have a general agreement as to what took place on that particular day, but we believe that information should be weighed by the jury and ultimately not by the court.
Thank you, Mr. Devitt.
Yep. So thank you, Your Honor.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Devitt. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Appreciate it.
We'll now turn to respondent's attorney. If you can please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And we do have, by the way, a clock. And so you can see how much time you have remaining, and you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Eric Holman, Donna Law Firm for Respondent Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern, or DM&E. I want to kind of jump around a little bit here. One of the things that I kept hearing from Mr. Davick was, you know, the jury should be looking at the totality of the circumstances. They should be looking at this particular crossing on this particular day. And that really goes against what preemption is all about. Preemption, the goal of preemption is national uniformity. To allow a jury to impose a duty at this crossing that was not seen fit to impose by the FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, undermines that goal of national uniformity from the Federal Rail Safety Act and the authority of the uniquely qualified FRA to assert its expertise regarding crossings. Allowing a jury in Dodge County, Minnesota, or anywhere else across this country to consider and find negligence based on railroad conduct that complied with governing federal regulations would thwart the goal of national uniformity. It would result in the establishment through verdicts of varying and uncertain standards, which is exactly what we're trying to prevent with Federal Railroad or Federal Rail Safety Administration preemption. It would allow piecemeal litigation across the country. What one jury finds to be negligent conduct at a certain crossing, another jury might find to be non-negligent at the same crossing. And that's exactly what preemption is designed to avoid.
So, Mr. Holman, I just want to make sure I understand your position here, just in diving into these facts. So, for example, using your logic, the only question would be, look, was a train going above the federally regulated speed? And if it doesn't, then there's no claims, as opposed to, look, you got to, you know, look at the situation at this non-controlled crossing, and, you know, maybe it's the time of day or the high traffic, and or whether there's a partial obstruction, and think reasonably should the conductor have slowed down. I mean, am I understanding your perspective on this?
Yes, and particularly to the issue of speed. Speed is preempted when federal regulations cover speed and when there's no evidence that the train exceeded that regulatory speed limit. Now here, the FRA regulations establish a maximum train speed under 49 CFR 213.9A, and the uncontradicted and objective evidence from the event data recorder, that's like the train's black box, if you will, shows that this locomotive was traveling both below the railroad speed limit of 30 miles an hour and the federal government's speed limit of 40 miles an hour.
And so from your perspective, we don't get to look at whether that's reasonable under the circumstances, or a jury doesn't get to look at that.
Absolutely not. Correct. That is correct. And I would note that the district court noted that in Mr. Caribou's brief in opposition to summary judgment, he did not provide any evidence disputing the train speed or the federal regulated speed limit. So that claim is preempted. The same holds true with respect to the quote unquote warning devices. That also is preempted, and there's a long line of cases, starting with Shanklin and Easterwood from the Supreme Court. Basically, all that's required for preemption on a warning device claim is federal funding plus installation of a crossbuck. And we have that here. There's no disputed facts there. So federal funds were used, a crossbuck was installed and present at the crossing, federal preemption applies. There can be no claim that they should have had this, that, or the other thing. They should have had alternate warning devices. That's exactly what preemption is designed to prevent.
Mr. Holman?
Yes, Judge.
Yeah, so even if we accept your arguments as true with respect to preemption on speed and with the railroad crossing warning system, there are still other issues that normally go to a jury. It's only in the rare case that a district court is allowed to grant summary judgment. These are, you know, in the vast majority of cases, these go to the jury. And it's not just those issues that arguably fall under preemption. You also have, what was the conduct of the railroad drivers at the time? Did they sound the horn? Did they put on the brakes? And so there are a lot of those issues that are still out there that typically should go for a jury, and particularly when you have a situation where you have comparable fault, because now you have to determine, okay, was one party at fault, was the other party at fault, and then what is the relative negligence between the two? That's almost always a fact question that goes to the jury. Why shouldn't this go to the jury as well?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. And frankly, I think the district court did a great job analyzing the various other theories that Mr. Caribou has set forth. Negligent train operations, specifically failure to brake or slow down, as you mentioned, prior to the impact. The law in Minnesota is that the engineer is not required to slow down or stop when he sees a car approaching the tracks. The duty to brake comes into effect only when a collision is imminent. And that's exactly what happened here.
What about the failure to keep a proper lookout? I mean, that seems to me, of these allegations, the one that would say, wouldn't that really require you, a jury or a fact finder, to look at, you know, all of the situations that appellant's counsel, you know, claimed, whether there's a lot of traffic, whether there's, you know, partial obstruction?
Sure. Thank you, Judge, for that question. Again, failure to keep a proper lookout. Both crew members testified via affidavit. This is uncontradicted. It's undisputed that they were looking down the railroad tracks and at the intersecting roads to observe and ascertain whether any persons or vehicle were in danger of being struck by the train. Again, that testimony is uncontroverted. There's no evidence whatsoever that the train crew failed to keep a proper lookout. In fact, there's no evidence marshaled whatsoever from Mr. Caribou's attorney in opposition to our motion for summary judgment. Absolutely every piece of evidence that the district court considered came from the railroad. Mr. Caribou obviously cannot recall anything about the accident. The only record testimony about what happened at the scene comes from the affidavits of the two crew members and also an eyewitness who was immediately behind Mr. Caribou at the time. And that was Susan Tufte Engdahl, I think is her name. Mr. Caravu and his counsel did not submit any other affidavits or other evidence contradicting or rebutting this testimony. The other evidence that we presented included an affidavit from Jeff McInnes relating to horn usage and train speed, an affidavit from David Scott regarding federal funding used in the Crossbuck project. He was with the FHWA Minnesota. And then also various documents, including Caravu's two traffic citations and documents relating to the Crossbuck project. Again, Mr. Caravu did not submit any evidence rebutting or refuting any of this evidence. The key facts here are undisputed. And I heard Judge Reyes ask Mr. Davick, what are the material facts that would point to DM&E's negligence? I didn't hear anything. Not one thing. There's not a single fact that points, that raises any sort of genuine issue of material fact as to DM&E's negligence. The engineer properly braked once the collision was imminent. They kept a proper lookout. In terms of these trees that could block the sight line, again, that's sheer inadmissible speculation. Mr. Caravu doesn't remember what happens. The train crew was able to observe all the cars on both Highway 14 and County Road 9. And I would point out that the tracks run parallel to Highway 14 before you turn on northbound onto Highway 9. Tufte testified that she saw the locomotive from both Highway 14 and County Road 9. Tufte testified that once she turned onto County Road 9, there were no trees, vegetation, or other obstacles obstructing her view. Photographs submitted, Google Maps images submitted, established that there is approximately 660 feet of unobstructed view from the crossing to that copse of trees or copse of trees. And for the district court, for those reasons just cited, didn't buy into this obstructed view theory. Use of a flagman or crossing guard, that is not only not required in this case, but it's preempted by state law. There is a statute, Minnesota Statute 219.23. And if the Commissioner of Transportation does an investigation and has a hearing and determines a crossing guard is required, then he can order one. That's not the case here. There's never been any investigation or hearing or order from the Commissioner of Transportation or the state to have a crossing guard at this particular location. The same holds true, by the way, to other signs or warning devices that may be present. There are ways for people, for a town, for townsfolk, for the population to say, hey, we think this crossing is not safe. We got to do something about it. There's a way to do that. You petition the Minnesota DOT. They have a hearing. They have an investigation. They look at it. And then they can make determinations as to what else might be required there. I would point the court to 219.20, 219.23, 219.40, and 219.402, which in this case, 219.402 indicates that crossing warning devices installed and maintained under this chapter as approved by the commissioner, which is what happened here, are adequate and appropriate warnings for the crossing. That's exactly what we've got here. The state has already approved the warning devices at this crossing, and it's not for a jury to determine whether that approval was reasonable or not. That's just the way that state preclusion and federal preemption work. You know, I really don't have anything else. I think the briefing is outlines our position and our opposition to this appeal fairly well. I note that Mr. Davick did not submit a reply brief. Unless the court has other questions, I will I'll submit further on the briefs.
I don't see any other questions from my colleagues. So thank you very much, Mr. Holman. We'll turn back to Mr. David for 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Much honestly, like the reply brief, I don't have any rebuttal absent questions from Your Honors. I would, as Mr. Holman pointed out, I think the materials were well briefed and there's plenty of information in there. So absent any additional questions, I would waive my time.
Okay, and I don't see any further questions. So